Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And while our friend Hal Bryan is on assignment, I'm your other co-host, Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And we are 102 minutes in, and this is kind of a lot of airborne stuff going on, which is really sad because we're missing Hal on this one. But I think it's a pretty good episode. Brian, would you care to take the helm and tell us what minute 102 is about?
I would love to, since there's no dialogue with which I would need to come up with accents for.
Oh, you can do accent if you want. I'm open to that.
All right. Aboard the Valkyrie, the pilot of the New York flying bomb shuts his canopy. Steve leaps onto the craft, prying at the canopy with his shield, but a Hydra pilot tackles him, sending the shield clattering onto a panel below the catwalk. The flying bomb's pilot flips a release lever, and the craft drops from the Valkyrie's belly, carrying Steve and the other Hydra pilot with it. The two grapple on the hull as the bomb's pilot waggles the wings, trying to shake Steve off. The craft dives, forcing Steve and his opponent to slide toward the nose. The pilot yanks the control stick back, and the men slide aft toward the spinning propeller. Steve grabs the vertical stabilizer, but the Hydra pilot isn't so fortunate, tumbling into the blades with a gruesome splash of red.
Yeah.
Steve forces open the canopy. You just like to see Nazis get it, don't you?
Yeah.
Steve forces open the canopy, startling the pilot inside. He yanks the ejection lever, launching the pilot into the sky. Steve slides into the cockpit, banking the craft back toward the Valkyrie. In the Valkyrie's cockpit, the Red Skull watches the flying bomb zip past his windows. He flips switches, and blue ray guns mounted atop the flying wing open fire. Steve, piloting the bomb, weaves through the stream of blue bolts, darting behind the massive bomber to avoid the deadly blasts.
Okay, I have questions. For example, where did Captain America learn how to fly a plane of any kind?
That is my note number one. Yes, that is exactly what I said. When did Steve Rogers learn to fly? Because it is not an easy skill to just slip into a cockpit and intuitively know what to do.
Yeah, he may have been the first member of the EAA that we just didn't know about. He went on a Young Eagles flight sometime in the 40s somehow and learned how to fly a plane. But
well, that's the other thing. These are all experimental aircraft. You know, even if you know how to fly a Cessna, you're not going to hop into a Hydra buzz bomb and know where the ejection seat is and all those things.
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, lucky guess, I think you'd have to know what is ejection seat in German?
Yeah. Well, as we were joking this morning on an entirely different topic, you hop in there and, you know, turn on the windshield wipers instead, you know? Yeah. But somehow Steve Rogers knows how to fly this thing. And yeah, not only fly, but to evade bolts that are traveling at something probably approximating the speed of light.
Yeah, I'm just my theory that I work on, and tying this back into comics, maybe he just read The Adventures of Smiling Jack, or there's another comic strip called Tailspin Tommy. So maybe he just read the little, and there was also another one called The Great Sky Roads, which my current obsession is reading old newspapers online, and I've been reading some 1931s called The Great Sky Road, which is kind of like, it has a bunch of pilots that are, if you ever read Wind, Sand, and Stars, it's like that. They're kind of, soldier of fortune types that are, you know, always getting in trouble in foreign lands. And one of the things that they have at the end of every panel, or at the end of the last panel, is kind of like what Dick Tracy had with Crime Stoppers textbook. It would tell you what to do. How to get out of a flat spin, or how do you find the absolute ceiling of an aircraft, and where, you know, what to do, what are different stall speeds of monoplanes and biplane, you know, and I was thinking maybe Steve was an avid comic strip reader and he'd get his New York Journal or Herald Examiner and just read Sky Rose and goes, oh, that's how you fly a plane. But that's my theory.
I consider myself very well acquainted with comic strip history. I've never heard of that one. You said it was 1931?
I think it was mid 1930s. There
Yeah.
was the Great Sky Roads. It was written by Dick Buck Rogers Calkin and
Oh
drawn
yeah,
by
the Calkin, sure.
Zach Mosley and Russell. Let me see, Russell Flying Jenny Keaton. With plenty of creative talent at the helm, it seems like the strip couldn't fail to be a success. And it was very successful when it appeared in 1929 as part of an explosion of new adventure strips. As the 30s progressed, the market for aviation strips was flooded with likes of Tommy Tailspin, Flying to Fame, and others. Sky Roads just couldn't keep its nose up, but it had become, in the mid-30s, it had become a strip that had appeared in a piddling number of pages. By the way, I'm getting this from comicstriphistory.com. I want to
Yeah,
make sure
they're
that,
good people there.
and
That's fascinating to me because from your first description with the soldiers of fortune and the pilots and such, it immediately put me in mind of Terry and the Pirates, which was a hugely successful strip, but it only started in 1934. So your strip predates that. I guess it was just a motif that was in the air back then, kind of like westerns would come along later or that kind of thing.
And
Interesting.
it was, I mean, you have to think just post Lindbergh,
Yeah.
so everybody wanted to be Lucky Lindy. And the only way I found out about this strip, as I said, I love looking through old newspapers and reading their comic strips. I used to live in Elizabeth, New Jersey, and the Elizabeth Daily Journal has been completely digitized. And if you go
Nice.
to the Elizabeth, New Jersey Public Library in their digital collection, you can read every paper that they've had. The Elizabeth Daily Journal, besides the Hartford Courant, was the oldest newspaper in the world, or in America. And you can go back hundreds of years and read all their daily happenings and goings and garage sales and street conflicts and obituaries. So
I love that.
quite a resource.
I'm not sure if you're weird, but if you are, I'm as weird as you are because I love that stuff, especially the old ads. And you never get the old ads when you just Google a newspaper article or something. It's a wonderful slice of life.
I mean, just even getting to see like department stores and seeing fashions that were going on.
Yeah.
You could see the cloche hats and flapper skirts and things going on. Or you can spin through and find Sky Roads at the, page 18, way in the back next to the Radio Times. So,
Your mention of Dick Tracy and Crime Stoppers, his Crime Stoppers tip in Airplanes reminds me of something I read in a Dick Tracy comic strip, one of those little Crime Stopper tips he always put at the end, or at the be I think it was up in the beginning, up in the header of the comic. I was a child, and one of the tips was when you're driving on a highway, look out for an aircraft coming along overhead because they may be looking for an emergency place to land on your highway. And I swear to God, every time I'm driving down a freeway, I've got half an eye on the sky, waiting to see a plane come down in front of me.
just to make sure. Well, that day could come, and you're be prepared. I think that's fortunate.
Know what happens from time to time? I'm always fascinated when it does.
The thing I remember at Crime Stoppers is I think it had a perforated line around the outside of the box, so you could collect a whole set, glue them into your notepad, and that way you would have a Crime Stoppers textbook of your own if you.
Yeah, I'd have to look it up, but as I recall, they had two little holes where you could hole punch and put them in a little teeny tiny binder. That's my memory of it. Canonically, if I may change direction here, I was fascinated by this minute because in the comics, this depiction of Captain America on this flying, I'm going to call it a buzz bomb. I don't know what else to call it. This almost cruise missile kind of weapon. Is very close to how Cap lost Bucky in the comics. Baron
Really?
Zemo was launching one of these things, one of these cruise missile devices, from Europe toward North America, and Captain America and Bucky got there at the last minute and basically leaped at the thing, grabbed onto its wings. It takes off. Cap and Bucky are flying this thing over the ocean. Cap's got a looser grip because he was the second one to leap. And so Cap falls off and yells, "Bucky, Bucky, drop. We can't stop it." And Bucky says, No, Cap, I can do it. I can do it." Kaboom. And that's how we lost Bucky in the comic strip or comic books. And so this whole sequence with Cap desperately clinging to this machine as it flies through the sky and banks and dips and loops and tries to lose him was very reminiscent to me. It immediately flashed me back to those panels of Bucky getting kaboomed and falling into the ocean.
For me being, the Joe Johnston memorial, the whatever. I'm the, you know, it feels like the concordance of Joe Johnston films. This is yet another scene of people scrambling off of a tilting, twisting aircraft. In The Rocketeer, the Rocketeer has to go save his buddy who's flying a Jenny, and he hasn't taken hands on a rudder in 25 years. So as Cliff Secord flies up, he goes to rescue his friend Malcolm, but unfortunately, as he punches through the bottom of the plane, he knocks Malcolm out. The rudder gets loose, the plane flips over, and the Rocketeer falls what seemingly to his doom. But of course, he has the rocket pack on, and he can fly right back up to the plane that he just disabled. And then we just had a series of him sliding down the fuselage, sliding down a wing, falling over, landing in the clouds, and firing up his X3 jetpack. So a very similar scene, and I think it takes about the same amount of time here. It's about a minute worth of adventure in the sky.
I love that scene in The Rocketeer. It's terrific. And it hadn't occurred to me, but of course, it feels like a dress rehearsal for this scene in Captain America.
Yeah, I keep thinking that The Rocketeer was Joe's audition tape for Captain America to come.
Oh, I think there's no doubt of that. I mean, hasn't that been explicitly stated by some of the producers and so forth? Is this is why we hired Joe.
He really captures it. And as you were saying in our previous episode, one of the key things here is the sound. And it's the sound of those propellers, the Doppler effects going on, all the sound of those blue bolts shooting out of the Tesseract guns. It really fills your head with the volume of things going on in front of you. And I enjoy the sound design in this minute, maybe more than any other minute. If there's so many things going on with the wind rushing, and the noise of the punches landing and the sliding around and stuff, I really feel like you're kind of sweating a bit as you're watching them turning and twisting on this aircraft.
Yeah, I have no specific memory of, seeing this particular scene in the theater, but I bet if you were in a good theater with proper speakers or even a nice home theater with the right kind of surround sound, this scene would just be spectacular because you would be surrounded by this noise that was coming and going from behind you and in front of you and left to right and right to left. I bet the sound design of this thing is just stellar.
Yeah, it is. It is stunning. Beautiful. I mean, this is VFX, and I don't think the clouds are plates. What they take, just pictures of clouds and drop them into the background. But the realism of the clouds is what gets me here. It's beautiful. It's almost, for lack of a better term, I think it's almost Maxwell Parrish involved in the amount of sunshine and clouds and darkness and depth. As as they're plummeting, it seems to be very realistic in terms of the color palette of reality.
That's a great call, Jim. I Maxfield Parrish is a wonderful reference here because you get a little pink in the sky and you get it feels like it's gosh, now I'm kind of looking at shadows and things, trying to figure out what time of day it is, because it sort of feels like it's getting toward the end of the day, but shadows seem to be coming from directly overhead, so it's not, but it feels like the end of something to me, which is appropriate thematically.
I do like the other thing about it is that they're shooting the sky through windows, which again locks you in the cabin with Cap as he's trying to get back. Being able to see you get that plane in your head, kind of like now this reminds me of speaking of clouds, the Cloud City, Bespin in Empire Strikes Back. Probably the same magicians that did that scenery learned from that and put extra thought in that. But the idea of looking through the window at the flying wing, that really feels very subjective, that you're Cap at that moment.
Well, and also the wrist shot of the Red Skull looking through the window of the flying wing at Cap coming around at him half a second later. It's a nice kind of yin and yang thing. We're getting the POV of both main characters here, flipping back and forth from one to the other.
And so many little tiny elements, like the Red Skull has the black and white television set, the televisor in front of him, with that very 30s looking. It almost looks like a kinescope that he's looking at things happening outside. But he, you know, of course, he would have some kind of a mechanical video rear screen.
Sure. I made note of a couple of just really nice little grace notes of VFX, visual effects work here. One is that when Cap is flying flying mom back toward the Valkyrie, you can see reflections of the blue bolts that miss him in his glass canopy. You don't
Yes.
see the bolts going by, but you see the reflections. So you get the sense of space, and this is real, and these are reflections of blue light flashing off the glass, even if you don't see the bolt. I love that. It's fantastic. There's a neat moment when Steve is still inside the Valkyrie, when his shield is knocked away from, and when it hits the ground, it gives off just a little, a tenth of a second of spark,
Oh,
just
okay,
a little
yeah.
pew. And that does so much to establish the reality of the shield and tell you that the shield is hard. It's harder than the stainless steel or whatever the Valkyrie's made out of. It raises a spark off the metal surface of this aircraft. I love that. And we both gave a nice ew to the blood splatter of the Hydragoon hitting the propeller. But just as an effect, it's beautifully done. First of all, there's the spray of there's the blood and guts of the guy hitting the propeller. But then in the scene that follows, there's a little trail of red mist that follows along behind the aircraft
Yeah.
for just a second, and it's like, oh man, that makes it real. That makes it palpable. You can almost taste that
Yeah.
blood coming off their propeller.
Yeah, it's very effective. You could hear the audience reaction after seeing that. One of the things I noticed that be there's a trick in cinematography that if you want to extend to make a scene seem more panoramic, have whatever objects you're looking at come toward you and then pan the camera left or right to make to show the rest of the sky. And there's a scene right when he starts coming back to the flying wing. He just closes the door on the flying bomb, and then you'll see the flying bomb come at you, fly past you, and then head back out to the flying wing, which
Yeah.
really it opens up this vista in your head, if not, you know, not on the screen, but in your head, you're like, oh, okay, this is a big arena that they're playing in. And it really, you know, it's a great cheat. It's a great way to get around. You don't have Cinerama, but it's a great way to show how wide the world is.
I remember you talked about this in an earlier shot when we see Steve riding a motorcycle through a forest, and you see him coming at you, and then as he passes the camera pans over to follow follow his back as it goes through the forest. And very similar thing here. What I like about this particular shot you're talking about is when you follow Steve's aircraft toward the Valkyrie, the reveal at the end is the Valkyrie just floating in the distance, huge, oppressive. It sort of calls to mind, we've already mentioned Star Wars once, so I'm going to say the very first shot of the very first Star Wars of that Star Destroyer coming overhead that just took our breath away in 1977. It's sort of reminiscent of that shot of the surprise of, oh, holy crap, there's that thing he's flying toward.
Yeah, and I mean we've already seen how big the tires themselves are. So if you think the tires are just little dots, you know, where the wheel wells are. So this thing is gigantic that he's up against. Now, how's he ever going to get back in there is what, you know, I mean that's
Yeah.
what it's setting up. It's like, what's he going to do? He can't. There's no runway. What's, you know, how does he handle this? So it does set you up for the next couple of minutes of figuring out, well, he's got to attack the Red Skull and save America somehow. But
So I think what we're getting here is toward the end of this movie, we're finally getting a handle on some of the tools in Joe Johnston's toolbox. And one of them is that shot you're talking about, that right to left or left to right kind of tracking is the wrong word, but the action where the shot where you follow the action and the camera pans to follow it. He's done that a few times in this movie. He's done it in other movies. And of course, other filmmakers have done it. He doesn't invent it, but it's one of his go-tos. And he doesn't overuse it. It's always tastefully done in the right place to communicate the right thing, as it is here.
yeah,
It's neat.
and I think from an artistic point of view, and Brian, you would know more about this than I do, but I think diagonal lines express action. Usually, static is the way I've understood any kind of motion when you're trying to present motion in any scene. the way to present dynamism is to have diagonals rather than having things in the horizontal or vertical planes. And I noticed there's so many diagonal action moments in this, just having everything cuts across the screen diagonally. And you always, the other thing, I mean, I used to do sports camera work, and one of the things in football was you always let the runners run into the frame so that you're not chasing them with the camera and moving the camera in the background. So a lot of these scenes, when you see cut after cut after cut, you'll see something from the edge of the screen heading toward the center of the screen, which also emphasizes the 3D nature of what you're watching. So it,
We've never talked about this. I used to do TV camera work,
wow.
not sports, but there's always a little leading space you leave in front of something that's moving to give it a place to go to. That's interesting. And the other thing artistically, since you started mentioning composition, is there's a lot of use of the rule of thirds here. And it's hard to see because there's so much action, but the idea is that if something's in the top third of the screen or the bottom third of the screen or the right third or the left third, it feels better balanced than just sitting dead in the center. It's more dynamic. There's more motion. Actually, I'm looking as I'm scrubbing through this minute. There's a shot of Cap in the cockpit of this bomb that's almost Kubrickian in it's just all the lines lead right to Cap, and
Yes.
Cap is dead center in it, and it's perfectly symmetrical, and it's really interesting because it establishes Cap as this kind of calm center of this action that is just going nuts all around him. But otherwise, the flying wing is always like in the top third of the frame, and Steve's aircraft is in there top third of the bottom third, and you could do almost like a Renaissance art analysis of every single shot of this minute.
And one of the things that started getting freed up in the 2010s is that most films were shot with the idea of television in mind, because television at the time, in the past, before, say the 20th century, was all 4x3. You're basically looking at a square, a slightly elongated square. But with the introduction of flat screens, wide screens, HDTV, we started getting into this 1.38 to one scale, that it's starting to turn into a bigger rectangle. And we don't have to you don't have to sell widescreen versus full screen videos anymore. People are switching to DVDs that assume that you're going to be looking at this in a widescreen format. So that opened it up for directors to say, I don't have to keep looking at that center box and seeing what they're going to see on old TVs anymore. And I think that really freed up. I mean, there are movies that were made with no thought of television in mind, but this really shows where you don't have to hang around the middle of the screen to get all the action going. But all in all, a
They use
beautiful,
every inch of real estate they can.
everything, every part of this is telling a story. It's just it really is great craftsmanship, and artistry.
Man, I swear this just really strikes me so hard. If anybody's really playing along with us at home, go to 53 seconds of this minute of the movie and look at that photo of Cap. Look at that shot of Cap sitting in the cockpit. And then you go look at Dave Bowman in 2001: A Space Odyssey walking through the Discovery with this, as he's going to deactivate HAL the computer. It's the same shot.
It
It's
really is,
just,
yeah.
it's really cool.
You're a foot away from his nose, and you're right. He's dead center, looking at things around him. But wow, what a great minute in a great movie. Well, we've got lots more to talk about on this, but I'm sure our audience is sitting there thinking of things and movies that they've seen that probably would fit in with this conversation. But if you'd like to join us and continue this conversation, we're always available over at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute Listeners Base on Facebook. If you do like the show, please don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our great big website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And we've got some really good guests coming up shortly. But be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
can do this all day.